The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
But now, BAFTA award-winning actress Miriam Margolyes has lived quite an extraordinary life, from Blackadder to Harry Potter to the cover of Vogue at the age of 83. All of this and so much more is documented from A to Z in her new book, which is called The Little Book of Miriam. I sat down with Miriam to talk about her little book, which is actually not such a little book. It's quite a sturdy tome.
It's a bit like myself.
It is small in layout, but robust in other ways.
Very strong in content, actually. And well, I have to tell you, I would like it in the lavatory, not on the coffee table.
Well, it is a book that you kind of dip into. It's called
exactly.
The Little Book of Miriam. What is the conceit of the volume?
Just that it's about me and about the things I think about and life, and what's happened in my life and my reaction to it. But some of the things are not suitable for children. So I don't want it to be available to children because it might corrupt and disturb them.
So the children are not permitted into the lavatory?
Not when the book's there. No, you can put it somewhere behind where they don't see it.
A high shelf in the lavatory?
Yes, if such a thing exists.
Now, the organisation of the book, it's alphabetical?
It is, not chronological.
So, being alphabetical, it's fairly random?
Totally. It's totally as if you just dipped into my brain and picked out a skerrick.
Let me dip in then. Accents, A.
Yes, well, accents are something that I've enjoyed them all my life, because Daddy was Scottish, so he had a rather serious voice like that, but he was a gentleman, much better class than my mother. My mother was of a lower class, and they met in a Jewish tennis club. I don't know whether you were aware that such things existed, and they may not now, but in those days, Jews were not allowed to play tennis with other religions. I don't know whether this
was... And was that an exclusion by the other clubs of Jewish people, or was it a rule of the Jewish people themselves?
It was an exclusion by the others, much as it was, now I must go back to myself, much as it was when they used to say on advertisements, no Irish, no dogs. I remember that, darling. I remember that.
The question, though, of accent and how it places you in the social strata. I mean, it is something that is probably less obvious here on this side of the pond, but certainly is probably still true in Britain, is it?
It is. You know, class runs England still. And the upper classes that I don't know very well, because I'm not part of the upper classes, but they always sound as if they're crying. You know, it's such a pleasure to meet you. How are you? Oh, yes, dear Miriam. Do come sit down here. There's a kind of scream behind it. I don't know why. And then there's the other sort, which I think is much nearer to what I like, which is like that, you know, it's sort of very relaxed and quite far back in a way, but not far back in the way that the upper classes are far back. And I love doing voices, because I think voices not only reveal where you come from, what your education was, but something about the person themselves. And I'm sure you listen to that when you're interviewing and you think, oh yeah, I know a bit more about them now. Am I right?
And you try not to presume, though.
Oh, I don't care about presuming. I'll presume. And then they'll put me right, if necessary.
So, going through life, obviously you've had to adopt accents for the various roles that you have played. Does it help you to be the person that you're trying to become in a part by capturing, either as Alec Guinness did, the walk, but in your case, maybe the accent?
For me, the accent, the voice, is the key into the person. Once I've found a voice for a person, I know who they are, I know how to present them, and I can become them. But before the voice, it's much harder. I need a voice to fix the person.
Now, you mentioned that your dad was Scottish and had a Scottish accent, but there's Glasgow and there's Edinburgh. Two very different accents and two very different milieus.
Indeed. I mean, Daddy was Glasgow, but he was Southside. So that's a very particular sound you know, that goes up at the end. And there's always a slight anxiety in it because they feel they're not quite as good as the West End.
Mm. Now, we're dipping here and there through the alphabetical book. There's one that jumped out at me, and that is Augustus John, the painter, and your early encounter with him.
That was an amazing time. I'd seen him on a television programme, face to face, John Freeman interviewing. And he captivated me, this amazing, huge guy in a boiler suit with a big beard and a cheeky expression, and yet serious behind it all. And I thought, I would love to be a model for that man. So I wrote to him, and I got the job, so to speak.
How old were you at the time?
17. And I was attractive in a voluptuous way, but not aware that I was attractive. I felt not attractive then.
Now, what is extraordinary to modern ears would be the notion that your parents would drop you off at the studio of Augustus John,
which they did.
With, shall we say, something of a reputation.
I think they didn't know that. I think if they'd known that, they might have been a little more circumspect. But Mummy just knew that he was famous, and she was an aspiring person. She wanted to mix with famous people, and she wanted me to be higher in the class than she was. Anyway, Dorelia, his wife, rang, and she was one of those people who talk like that. And so Mummy was absolutely charmed. And so she said yes to my being in the nude, because they told me before that I would be required to strip off to be a model, and I said I would do it for nothing. I think that's what charmed them. And so I turned up at the door, and there he was.
Hey, this lovely, big, boisterous, confident man, but very, very kind. And he said, do you play Shove Ha'penny?
And I said, no, I don't think I've ever... What is it?
And he said, well, I'll show you.
So we played Shove Ha'penny for a bit. And then I noticed a picture on the wall, which I thought was probably one of his. And I said, did you paint that?
And he said, no, my sister Gwen painted that picture. And in time, people will come to realise she's a much greater painter than I am.
And that is the case. He was a great draughtsman, but she was a great painter.
Anyway, you stripped off, and no,
I did.
No harm befell you.
None at all. He asked me to climb a ladder, which I thought was a bit weird. But anyway, I climbed, because you feel a bit exposed when you're totally naked. But he'd stroked his beard and appreciatively said,
very nice, very nice. Your skin takes the light.
It's a nice thing to be told.
Is the picture extant?
I've no idea.
You could be hanging on someone's drawing room wall or in a museum somewhere.
I think it was part of a sketch of something that he was doing called The Bathers, but I don't know. I continued to write to him until he died.
Your Jewishness permeates this little book of Miriam.
It does, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I hadn't
again and again and again.
I
mean, under B, we have bacon, which you have never consumed.
That's because it's forbidden to Orthodox Jews. I'm not Orthodox. In fact, now I have no faith, but I have a culture. I have memory. And that is the Jewishness of me.
Now, you went to a kibbutz, under K, I learned that.
Yes.
And it wasn't the happiest encounter.
No, because I had to work. And I didn't like that very much. I had to wash dishes for 500 people. In the end, I said, I'm not doing this, I'm sorry, is there any other job? And they said, yes, you can pick the oranges in the fields. So I did that instead.
But you came back with a somewhat jaundiced view of the kibbutz, which was not the view you had when you aspired to go there.
Yes, I was disappointed by the kibbutz. It wasn't for me. I don't think communal living is for me. I really don't. And they're rude and aggressive. And I had ideas of my own importance, probably. And I got up their nose a bit, Jewish nose.
You, I suppose, it foreshadowed some of the feelings you have about Palestine today and the way Israelis, and I don't say Jews, although there is a conflation in many people's minds of the two terms.
And that is the problem. That is the problem. Zionism is a political creed. Judaism is a faith, a religion. And people have muddled them up. And that's why some Jews are afraid to pray and wear the Magen David, the Shield of David, on their as a necklace. But it's not right. Look, Palestine is a place. It is a land. It belonged to the people who lived there when they were there. Nobody should be kicked out. I was utterly appalled by it, and particularly by the horror of the October the 7th attack by Hamas. But it comes from a context. It's not just out of nothing. And when I was in Israel, I saw how Palestinians were treated. I went to the West Bank, and I went also to Gaza. I've been in Gaza. In fact, I was stoned in Gaza because they could see, you know, Palestinians can tell if you're a Jew. And I was stoned because I was the oppressor. But I understood it. I bore no hatred for that. And I try not to hate now. It's hard.
But you are, in some areas of where you live, among Jewish people, persona non grata now.
That's true. Yes, they
simply
believe...
Simply because of the outspokenness of your feelings for the oppression of Palestinians.
Exactly. They feel I've betrayed my people, and I feel that they have betrayed my people.
You've said in one interview I've seen that in some ways Hitler won. What do you mean by that?
One of the main good things about Jewish people is their compassion and their recognition of the humanity of others. That is no longer the case where Palestinians are concerned. And I think that's a result of the Holocaust, that Hitler was able to change our attitude. Obviously, because it has changed. We don't have compassion now for Palestinians. We bear hatred. We bear contempt. They're not considered human. Otherwise, we would not treat them in that way.
We're talking all the time now about the mental health implications of what has gone on in Gaza over the last while. But there may be an interpretation of what happened to the Jewish people as a whole as a result of the Holocaust, that this is all the things we see that we don't necessarily like about the way they behave is a kind of a protracted post-traumatic stress disorder.
Exactly.
Based on the Holocaust.
Exactly. He was victorious ultimately in his power over us. He's dead. Hitler's dead. But what he did and what others did in his name has survived, and it has corrupted us and turned us into something I dislike intensely.
Moving on to other matters, because the book is so comprehensive and I learned all sorts of things about you. For example, you were the first person to use the F word on television.
Not something I'm proud of, by the way, but it is apparently the case. You can see my mouth enunciating that word, but the sound was cut.
What were the circumstances?
I got an answer wrong. And anybody
would swear.
This was
University Challenge.
University Challenge. Yes, I got a wrong answer. And I don't like being wrong.
So you said, bleep.
Yes. And my diction has always been very clear. And my enunciation also. So you can see what I'm saying.
So it rang throughout the studio.
It did, I'm afraid. And Bamba Gascoigne, may his memory be a blessing, remembered it more than 60 years later when I met him again.
There's another theme running through your book. It comes again and again about your own sexuality and how you realised that you were gay. And in terms of all your work for LGBT plus, et cetera, you are definitely L.
I'm a gay woman. I'm a lesbian and I love it.
That's a, you say, I'm not bi, I'm L, I'm lesbian.
Absolutely. I mean, I've handled fellas.
You've had your encounters.
I've had my encounters with fellas, and I've enjoyed them, and I hope the fellas have too. That's what it's about. But I'm what I am, and I always have been. I didn't know it till I was 27. I mean, it's rather late to begin.
You also do a meditation on coming out and the wisdom of or not.
Yes, because people, when you discover your sexuality, you want to tell everybody. Particularly, I wanted to tell my parents, the people I was closest to. I have no brothers and sisters. But they were the very people I should not have told, because they were unable to absorb it without pain. I hurt my parents, and I loved my parents so much, and yet they were the people I hurt. So I advise, do not tell people who can't handle it.
So even though it may become apparent, often there is a debate among families. Oh, well, I knew he was gay all the time, or I knew she was gay all the time. And there's one particular situation where someone said, you knew I was gay, well, why didn't you tell me? That can happen.
It can happen, but I want to protect people from pain. I want to give pleasure and protect from pain. And I think if you're lucky enough to be gay, if you just keep it to yourself, if it's going to cause pain by talking about it.
Now, you are very direct, very forthright, and in certain situations, even you can get embarrassed, which is not very often. And I'm thinking of, under the D's, I came across Dolly Farton.
I knew you were going to talk about fart sooner or later. I mean, yes, a fart builds. It's something that I don't let it out immediately. They build inside your gut, you know. And I was at a Dolly Parton concert and we had a meet and greet to look forward to afterwards. It was in the tunnel underneath Wembley, where she had been playing. And we were waiting there, and I took Graham Norton with me as my kind of plus one. And he's a sweetheart. I'm sure you know him. But I think I really frightened him, because eventually it had to come out. And I thought it better come out before I meet Dolly Parton herself. So I felt it building. And in the tunnel it exploded with an astonishing resonance that rumbled on and on down the tunnel. I don't think Graham's ever got over it, because he always mentions it when I see him.
So when you finally got to meet Dolly, you were perfumed like a milliner.
I don't know what the perfume was like, but I was safe, because my farts don't come accompanied, luckily.
Throughout your life, you've had many chapters, and I was wondering what impact your role in Harry Potter had, Professor Sprout. Did that bring you to a whole new audience, and therefore, on the streets as you walk by, a lot of attention that might otherwise have not been present?
I think Harry Potter gave me young people. I don't think young people would know who the hell I was if I hadn't been in Harry Potter, and I'm grateful for that. I'm not somebody who enjoys that kind of film. I've never read the books. I've only seen myself on the screen when I was at the premieres, and if it wasn't me on the screen, I fell asleep. And really, I had such a small part, I was asleep most of the time. So they're not my thing. But for a lot of young people, it's their childhood. They grew up with it. And she's a jolly good writer. You know, she creates a world. It's just not my world. So I was glad of the money, glad of the recognition. Mind you, the money could have been better. But I was glad of the recognition. And I'm still glad. I'm still grateful.
There are so many elements to your life, but perhaps one of the most unexpected would have been becoming a cover girl for Vogue.
Well, there's a fashion thing going on now in Dublin, and when I came out of the hotel, I saw all these, you know, young models behaving like models and being photographed, and they recognised me because they'd seen me on the cover of Vogue. Well, I never thought that would happen.
And how did it come about? Because
I don't know. They wrote to me and said, "Would you like to be, would you like to be in a Vogue article?" I didn't know I was going to be a cover girl, but I'm terribly pleased. And then the photographer, Tim Walker, he wanted to photograph me nude. So it wasn't just Augustus John that saw me nude.
Now, you also, under N, you discuss nudity.
Yeah.
And?
Well, I don't think you have them here, but there's something called a baker shop called Greg's, and they do buns with little cherries in the middle. And they were to cover my breasts. So I wasn't going to have anything below the waist. Okay. I draw the line there. So, but I was naked. I just lay on the floor and exposed the upper part of my body, covered by Greg's buns. Now, I gave them to the crew afterwards. the buns, I mean. So, not the breasts.
But you were hugely impressed by the way the whole operation ran. I mean, hordes of people arrived. You don't have to do anything in advance, and they do everything for you, including the buns.
Well, indeed, they know how to do it. And I had always despised fashion before. I thought it was not for people like me. You know, I'm sort of too high-minded. Not at all. This is a kind of art, and they know how to present people and how clothes change mood, change perception. It is a remarkable operation, and I have nothing but admiration for them.
Have you been buying Vogue ever since?
Never. I've never bought Vogue. Actually, I bought 4 copies of me, but I truly haven't read it since, because it's not my world.
What is your world now? How confined is it? How big is it?
It's less confined than it was, because I've started doing documentaries, and that means I travel and meet people abroad and can ask questions, much as you're doing, and learning about other cultures and other lives. And I find that fascinating. But I've got older. I'm 84. I have spinal stenosis. I can't run. I can't escape from anything. I can only frighten by shouting. That's the only thing that can...
The only weapon.
The only weapon I have, and I'll use it if necessary.
I suspect it might be terrifying.
The voice is, but I am a very lucky old lady, and I know that. So I'm grateful that I've been allowed to live this long and still earn money. And what is delightful about my book is it's in the bestseller lists. I'm making money. And, you know, I do love money.
I presume there will be a follow-up, a slightly larger book of Miriam.
There will be a follow-up, but it will be more serious. I think it's time I showed the thinking Miriam, you know? And it'll still have sex in it. It'll still be shocking, because that's what people expect from me. But I want to give them the other side, the sharper side of me. I've just got to set about finding it.
It strikes me that you're something of a mischief maker. I mean, you would not be happy appearing on Graham Norton without bringing him to paroxysms of laughter or his eyebrows shooting up through his scalp.
I want to make people laugh. I mean, that's something I've been gifted with. I'm not a comedian. I don't know what it is, but there's something about who I am that makes people laugh. They smile when they see me. And some people actually shout out, "Oh, I love you!" When I was on the plane, you know, people were saying that. And that is a gift, isn't it? And that's so nice for me, to go to my grave knowing that I have been liked.
I hope not any time soon, by the way.
I hope not, too.
the final question really is about your appetite for life. It's undiminished. So where do you think that comes from?
It comes, I think, from Mummy and Daddy, because I was conceived in an air raid. And I think both the terror and the glory of having survived have gone into my genes, into my blood, into my heart, and they have engined me through my life.
So literally, at the time of your conception, the earth moved.
It sure did, kid.
Miriam Margulies, thank you very much for joining us. The book is called The Little Book of Miriam, and it's absolutely terrific.
Thank you so much for having me on your programme.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.